and gentlemen, glad to be with you today. I'm Henrik, and it's good, as always, to speak with you. It's been a very, very busy weekend here as we are continuing to work on our Charleston Church shooting in-depth video. Some very revealing things that will break on this story. Absolutely fascinating. So stay tuned for that, and don't miss it once it's out. Well, today we have Kurt Doolittle with us, and this was recorded before the shooting occurred. Otherwise, we might have brought this into the discussion as well, but the topic is somewhat different. Kurt is an American entrepreneur, author, living in Kiev, Ukraine. He is an independent theorist of political economy in the conservative libertarian tradition and founder of the Propertarian Institute. Kurt is with us to share his work surrounding propertarianism, which can be defined as the philosophy of truth-telling and a response to conservatives' lack of rational and scientific language for discussing the evolutionary strategy of ancient Western civilization. Welcome, Kurt. It's lovely to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us on the program today. Hope you're doing well today.
I am, and thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
You bet. It's going to be very interesting and exciting. I heard you on TRS, I guess it's called, The Right Stuff, a couple of about a week ago, and it was a really interesting show. You had some great stuff to share with the guys, and I wanted to bring you on and talk more about your work and basically hear more about propertarianism. It's a very interesting material that you have to share here. But before we kind of get into the meat of some of that, maybe you can tell us a little bit about your background here at the start, if there's something you'd like to let us know about. What do you think our audience should know who might not be familiar with your work, Kurt?
Well, I don't. It's one of those things. Where do you want me to start? Most people know a little bit about me. I'm a serial entrepreneur. I am a serial entrepreneur, so I can make enough money so that I can write full time, and so that's what I have luxury pretty much to do. And so since about 2009, I've been working pretty much full time on political philosophy, political economy. I grew up in a small town in upstate New York in a little Mennonite farm village and farm town. It's sort of frozen in 1914. It's somewhat idyllic. I have a touch of Aspiness, which is I try to help other people with. I studied fine art in college, art theory, art history, and I tend to see human history through an artistic lens. That's pretty much it. Other than my company's a bit of the technology space, and I don't think that's very interesting to talk about. So I usually stick with philosophy.
Sounds good. Now, of course, you're in Kiev. Do you mind telling us how you ended up there?
Sure. So, one of the things that I try to get across is that, life is all well and good until something serious happened. And I got very ill. I had cancer twice. And at that point, I realized I needed to stop worrying about accumulating toys and things. And if I wanted to finish my work, I needed to commit over to that. So I basically sold everything and thought I'd live the next phase of my life on some adventure. And so I knew what the business, my friends and I decided what the business we wanted to get into. And so I just looked for a place to do it inexpensively. Because if you are in, you build a product like we're building or I build here, you can, in the States, that's a $5 million investment before you get the doors open just in development costs. And, I can do it out of my pocket here in Kiev instead of bringing an investor and giving away most of the equity. So,
right.
That was the real reason we came to Ukraine, is because for purely financial reasons. Great people here, and Roman Skaskier, who you might know or not, set me up, and I just decided to stay here because of how much I love the culture and how much I love the country.
Very good. I hope it's, fairly peaceful, I guess. Has it been, I don't know what area you're in, but has it been a wild ride the last year or so?
Well, what's wild is watching a fairly poor country, a fairly poor post-Soviet country riddled with the remnants of post-Soviet corruption, desperately free themselves of that legacy. And so as a bit of a social scientist, I think that, having a front row seat at this kind of game is a privilege. But to watch the economy fall apart is heartbreaking, because especially if you care about the people, and I do love them very much, and we all know what's going on. I mean, they're afraid of democracy spreading to Russia, so they invoke nationalism by propaganda and attacking the East, and for various reasons, this just toasts the economy. And I guess the basic strategy going on right now is to figure out which happens first: Russia's economy collapses, or the West gives in and Ukraine gives in. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a good thing for Ukrainians, but as an advocate of freedom, I have to. I feel privileged to be with them in their journey.
Yeah, exactly. I remember just a couple of days ago we posted the story, the hacked emails between George Soros, and I forget which position he was in, the guy in Ukraine. Poroshenko, the president, of course. And talking about how he basically admits in the email they were hacked, of course. So he didn't think that anyone was listening or reading, but he's definitely trying to pull the strings behind the scenes to get them into a war and give them weapons and everything else. So I'm very worried about this whole situation, you know?
Well, I mean, we're at war, right? I mean, there's 10,000 Russians on Ukrainian soil, and we're already at war. I mean, it's the problem is that they had, the world's largest collection of nuclear arms, and they gave them all up under the presumption that they'd be protected, and now they don't have any. They're all gone, and what Putin has just done is broken the post-war consensus. And he's told everybody in the world the only sovereignty you really have is nuclear weapons. So I expect to see a rapid proliferation of nuclear weapons and probably expansion of Poland as the regional power. We'll see.
Wow. All right. Well, we'll see if there's more opportunity to maybe talk about some of those things later. But let's just kind of dive into the main topic that you've been working on then. I don't know how long. You can tell us more about that too. But proprietarianism. Let's just kind of define the term, I guess, and just give us some of the basics.
Well, I'll start out with the sort of history, if that helps. And that's that, I've had a long-standing interest in philosophy, for most of my life, but I have a highly scientific bias that I'm consciously conscious of. I've been carrying this with me, but when I started out, my ambition was pretty simple. I just was frustrated that conservatives had no real language. They have no scientific, not even a rational language, and those are very specific terms, for discussing their ancient Western civilization. They don't have a language for it, and this is because it wasn't really written down. It was just practiced and intuited over and evolved over a couple of thousand years. And so I got frustrated especially during the 90s when the left in America was just trying to get airtime and chant the same phrase over and over again without engaging in argument. And so, and then the conservatives would come on and argue their position, and it was done in historical, analogical, or moral language that, that we've sort of left behind 100 years ago. And so I said, I'm going to set out to try to define a rational language for expressing this. And I didn't have any ambitions to end up where I ended up today, but fairly revolutionary way of looking at the world, I think. But so by 2006 or so, I knew that the institutional solution to post-democratic polities was. And I got kind of stuck for a while there when I realized that the propaganda, or the ability to lie, pseudoscience, had been so successful over the 20th century in undermining our heritage, or our Western morality. So if you want to say something's really simple, propertarianism is sort of the philosophy of telling the truth, what we would call testimony. If you wanted to say something sort of utilitarian about it, that would be that propertarianism is sort of amoral, meaning non-moral, which is it's not loaded with moral sentiments. It's a formal logic for criticizing ethical, moral, and political statements. And criticizing means something very specific in philosophy. It means that when you're trying to work in a contractual sense, right? If you're in a state of law, or if you're trying to work in a moral contract, in other words, in statements of norms, you justify your positions. Because you're saying, I did this and I have permission to do this for these reasons. But when you're talking about science, science is critical. We don't actually know anything that's true. We just know what's false. And so you're always trying to test your hypotheses to see if it survives. And so you look for ways of criticizing your hypothesis to see if it can succeed or fail. So propertarianism takes this sort of scientific view of morality and flips it around. So you can use propertarianism to construct using law a government, any government, whatever your political bias is. But you can do it without having to rely on deceit. Right. Error,
right.
Bias, framing, loading, overloading. So you can have an honest discussion, just like you can have an honest discussion about a political philosophy and propertarianism if you want. So as a logic, that allows you to have unloaded conversations on one hand, but it also allows you to attack loaded conversations as dishonest, pseudoscientific, immoral, or deceitful. Whatever you want to say, however you want to put it, whatever the person is attacking you, by restating that person's position in amoral language.
Do you think, is there a need to fight the moral arguments that the left has brought to the table, because they've managed to gain quite a bit on doing that, right?
Oh, of course. So if you said, let me walk through one other point there, and
I'll try it,
which is that. So what I ended up it's sort of a misnomer to when I use the word propertarian. It's just what happened is I started out with ethics, propertarian ethics. And everyone told me, well, now that you've made this name, you've pretty much got to stick with it. But what I call propertarianism actually consists of a bunch of little things that fulfill what's called the Wilsonian synthesis. Which E.O. Wilson promised us back in his tome there a number of years ago, that we would see the unification of biology, morality, ethics, law, and politics, sometime in the near future. And I think propertarianism, or the end of that, pretty much brings that into being, which why it's so important probably for you and I and generations to follow. So propertarianism consists of a couple of pieces: testimonial truth, which is truth proper. In other words, if you ask a dozen philosophers what truth means, good luck getting the answer, because we all intuit it, but you have to. But I've defined what truth is in the only way possible. The second thing is testimonialism, which is the completion of the scientific method and the transformation of philosophy from justificationism to critical. Thought, mm-hmm. criticism, and I've added three additional logics or criticisms to philosophy: operationalism, which is the testing of existential possibilities and limits; full accounting, which is a test against selection bias; and morality, that tests any statement whether any statement is objectively moral. Now, I don't know what that means to anyone, right? I mean, if you're not a professional in this field, I suppose it sounds like a bunch of nonsense.
So
I'm going to flip it around and say, well, if I started out by saying, what's the language of conservatism, or why did I want to get conservatives to be able to speak about their Western philosophy or Western traditions in rational language? And then I ended up talking about testimonial truth, testimonialism, and trying to merge philosophy and science into the language of truth-telling. I did that because it occurred to me fairly early on that the Western evolutionary strategy is that we're the only people that tell the truth. So I mean truth in the sense that we testify and our testimony corresponds with reality. You can see this everywhere, but I mean, it originated in our military culture, our martial culture, probably during the, Indo-European or Kurgan invasions, the Mata culture. And so we developed this art of truth-telling. We developed it first as just a necessary outcome of tactics. Second, we developed it in Greece as the means of testifying in front of a jury that we call the representative government or the Senate. That turned into debate, which turned into logic, which turned into science, which gave, you know, an Aristotle, which turned into the competitive advantage that the Western civilization has. Now, why would truth telling be so valuable? Well, the reason it's valuable is that if you combine telling the truth, which dramatically decreases the friction of exchange, taking risk, and you then get down to juries where you can talk to a jury and decide a jury, and that means which decide if some crime is actually committed by a jury. You can, and you have the common law, which organically evolves. What happens is that you have the ability to outlaw something in the common law very, very quickly, almost
right.
immediately, with the first case that comes up, and it suppresses the ability for the bad habits to become indoctrinated or norm. To turn into norms or accepted practices very, very rapidly. So what happened is Westerners developed the high truth society by suppressing very rapidly, mostly through the common law or some variation on it, or organic law. We actually suppressed every means of parasitism, free riding possible, so that we even end up with absolute nuclear families, so your children aren't even allowed to parasite off you. And so what you get out of this is you got incredible economic velocity relative to other cultures, which you all will always hear from other social philosophers. And I'm going to wrap this up in a second, so I'm just trying to get through the first draft of it with you, so that
no worries.
So that you have an idea of the scope.
Yeah.
What you get with, let's say, in China is you get Sun Tzu, who teaches you to deceive, right? I mean, that's his principal art, is delay and deceive, which is part and parcel of their civilization. Well, they were wealthy. They formed a bureaucracy easy and early and got a lot of trade, but they never could develop the answer to the solution of politics. In other words, construction of self-organizing commons. And what they do is it's still a deceit-oriented culture. So whenever, even though they discovered stuff earlier, the velocity at which they moved ahead with it was limited. Whereas if you look at the two great civilizations in the West, or the three, which is the Greco-Roman, you know, the Greeks were on the verge of the Industrial Revolution by AD zero. we had Rome come apart in there, and for, you know, Athens and Sparta decided to do what Germany and England did and destroy their culture through internecine warfare. But, you know, the minute we got Greek rationalism back into Northern Europe and the North Sea culture, we got between modern Athens and Sparta, between England and Germany,
mm-hmm.
we got another industrial revolution just as fast. So the central argument I've tried to get across is that the discipline of science has been held in place for a very long time. But what science really has taught us is it's actually just the art of telling the truth by applying a bunch of criticisms that allow us to launder imagination, bias, error, and deception from our rather animalistic brains that are really good at free association, but did not evolve to tell the truth. They evolved so we can negotiate with one another. And so propertarianism is really a misnomer. It's really, that just refers to the ethics, but testimonialism, which is the overall piece, is the overall work, is really the philosophy of Western civilization written down so that we understand ourselves what our competitive strategy was. Why is it that the West, despite being poor people on the edge of the Bronze Age, small in number and far behind, both times when given the opportunity to work with rationalism, developed the Industrial Revolution twice and are responsible for most technical innovations in human history? And so
yeah.
I'm trying to restore truth-telling.
Interesting. Yeah, I like that idea. I mean, that's been the philosophy of this program for ever since its inception. We want to know the truth and practice it as well at the same time. Now,
but human minds aren't made to tell the truth.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and we didn't evolve this way. I mean, truth, that's why science is so hard, or speaking the truth is so hard. That's why it's so rare. It's expensive. I mean, we pay a very high cost in the West for telling the truth. No one else is willing to pay that cost. We can pay it for very, you know, mostly geographic reasons, cultural reasons, outbreeding being one of them. But I mean, it's expensive. If you think of truth and property rights and the jury and economic and our rich, high trust society with a high velocity economy, you think of that as a commons, like a, you know, as a common construction, as a public works project. I mean, it's incredibly expensive, and that's why nobody else has done it.
And it's okay. So it could be obviously low, maybe yield for the individual, but obviously when people come together and do something like this, you can achieve incredible things, right?
Well, that's right. And so the West, our competitive advantage is we can build commons, and we're really, really, really good at it. And so this is my attack on libertarianism, is that it's not Western at all. It's actually Levantine, and it's tribal. And I say, well, why would we give up high trust suppression of all high trust cultures, high economic velocity, total suppression of parasitism and free riding in every walk of life, in every, between everybody in life, and our ability to use juries and our ability to nearly eliminate demand for the state? Why would we do that to adopt the Rothbardian libertarianism, which is a low trust Levantine polity strategy that doesn't suppress free riding in all its places or produce high trust? Why would we do that? That's nonsensical. I mean, the only way to get rid of the state and its evil impact on us is to reduce demand for the state, not to encourage people to believe yet another hokey religion.
So it's yeah, because I mean, you posted I think it was a couple of days ago the family tree, if you will, of proprietarianism, the sequence of thinkers, and obviously you did include Mises, Ludwig von Mises, in there, and I think you talked about Rothbard before as well, but it's still It's a critique of that system, but at the same time bringing in some of the elements of it. Or how do we approach that?
Well, sure. So here's how I approach it, is that my work and the reactionary movement, which whether or not I'm a member of that movement, we can sort of go back and forth on, but is that the Enlightenment project failed. We can't create an aristocracy of everybody because not everybody's capable of aristocracy, and it's not in their interest to create it. So the classical liberal project has been a failure. But the Enlightenment era, you know, affected all cultures in Europe, and it certainly the three I care most about, and I just write off the French as nonsense. So I care about the three as Anglo-empirical, German rationalist, which we tend to think of in Kantian terms, because Kant's really the author of it. So Hume and, you know, Smith and Hume, Kant, and, you know, Hobbes, Locke, Smith, Hume, versus Kant and the German idealists, and the Jewish Enlightenment, which consists of an awful lot of people like Marx and Freud and Mises and Cantor and Rothbard and, you know, the entire Frankfurt School and all those people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we, each of those Enlightenments, what they did, you know, the English did, is they took their vision and said, let's make this our reproductive, our economic, our cultural strategy, which is that of an island people with a very powerful navy sitting behind a great big fortress wall called the ocean. And let's make that a universal statement of good. And now let's be the Germans. And the Germans are a different people. They're a landed people surrounded all sides whose history is basically one of defending Europe from the east. And they have a slightly different ethical system, which is much more oriented on duty and less on liberty. And they're going to say, well, we are going to universalize our ethical system as what's right and moral for man. And you had the Jewish system, which is not one of landholders, but one that's diasporic. So they don't have all these concepts of we have to have all these moral obligations in order to each other to create commons and to hold the land. And they have a huge, long history of hermeneutic interpretation, you know, studying the scripture and complex verbal arguments. And so it's interesting as we get out of this, is we get Anglo-idealistic imperialism with a completely incorrect view of man. We get German with a completely corrupt view of man, but just restating Christianity in this pseudo-babble that we call, which I'm going to get shot for by a whole bunch of philosophers,
right.
The pseudo-babble talk we called rationalism, mm-hmm. which is just a form of justifying your conclusions. And we have what came out of the Jewish hermeneutic school, which ended up being, strangely enough, pseudoscience. And so, out of this we get so everybody failed. The entire Enlightenment project. French, we just discount as nonsense. Anglo-empirical failed because it has the wrong view of man. German has the right view of man, but has a ridiculous argument. And the Jewish, which is a completely ridiculous argument, completely against the production of the commons, and has is counterproductive for Western civilization. Production of commons. I mean, because their strategy is, Jewish strategy is really pretty simple. It's we need to make the world safe for us.
Right. Well, yeah.
The Germans have a different strategy. So we need to keep all the evil people at bay.
Right.
And the English are like, well, the Angles are operating on the assumption that, hey, we got this nice little house back here behind the fortress of the sea, let's use our ships and go trade with everybody, and we'll be outlandishly puritanical and neo-puritanical, if not egalitarian with them, and they'll all turn into nice, happy, idealistic people like us. So what's happened is all three of these movements failed. And so when you go back to the heritage, of course, I have Mises and I have Rothbard in there. Mises is very interesting because he failed so tragically, and I'll tell you about that in a second. Rothbard gave me a gift I just can't believe, which he took the basic idea of Locke and he built a system of it. Now, it was a ridiculous hermeneutic system, and it was based on this German rationalist nonsense, and he tried to make it a pseudoscience, just like Marx and Mises had done, but he did come out with a gem there, and you saw Hoppe get a hold of it, and he tried to fix it as much as he could, but he's still part of that German rationalist post-Marxist universe over there, and he still built it on justification instead of science. So I have to look at all these universes and say, well, the Germans are right about their vision of man. We need to have duty. We need to construct commons. The Anglos are right because they argue scientifically in everything they do. And the Jewish people understand this thing of property and they can launder all this moral nonsense out of it. And so I sort of try to take a little bit of everything from everybody I could to try to find out if the Enlightenment project failed, how did it fail? It was unscientific. It's insufficiently scientific and for obvious reasons. And what do we do with it now that we know that that was the problem? So.
Interesting. Yes, yeah, so it's like looking at history with, a long view and seeing what has happened. And because we've spoken quite a bit on the program as well, that how the Enlightenment specifically coming out of France was built a lot on superstition and even some of the deities that they chose to bring back, like the great architect of the universe and these kinds of things. It was pseudo-Freemasonic kind of movement, right?
Yeah, I mean, they were desperate to hold on to what they understood, all of them. The English, the French, the Germans, and the Jews were all desperate to hold on to their past. Because what else is your binding narrative? What holds you together as a people? And if you pull that away from people, I mean, you just sort of spin away from the center by the centripetal force. And so everybody wants to hold their communities together and restate their common good without the authority of the church. But I don't know you think your readers understand, anything about the, I mean, if you have like 10% of your readers understand programming or your listeners understand programming or something like that, I can tend to get the point across in that language. If not, then I can tell a quick story here, if that'll help.
Yeah, let's do that. That's always good, too, give a little reference, yeah.
So imagine we had Einstein, right? Einstein came along. Now, when Einstein came along, he was a tremendous innovation. But it's hard to understand what his innovation was today, because he basically, we call it changed the frame. And he started looking at things that we thought were constant that aren't, right? Well, he says, well, relativity is wrong because it's actually constancy. But what happened was somebody looked at his work, and this guy's name was Bridgman, and he was a physicist. And he said, actually, we screwed up 50 or 80 years ago, and we should have discovered this back then. And that's because we've let some of this pseudoscientific language work our way into our practice of science.
Yeah.
Right? And he said, what's happened is we used to think about things as operations, as steps. Do this, then do that. This happens, that causes that consequence. But what we had done with mathematics back from, you know, from ancient history is mathematics has always had a sort of mystical attribute to it. And mathematicians had stopped using operational language. So they would say, if you do this, then you can do this, and then you can do this, and therefore this can be true. And they started developing all sorts of shortcuts and funny names, things like that, which I can go into in painful detail, but I will, you know, I'll lose everybody but the three guys out there who are specialized in mathematical philosophy.
Right, yeah.
So what happens is you get this idea of this disconnectedness happening in mathematics, and it's applied in physics because mathematics is beginning to be used a lot in physics. And so physics becomes non-operational. Yet this movement Bridgman brings about to try to restore it to science doesn't work. They say, well, this is too much of a burden and this, the other reasons. But in the end, what happens is you see the change in scientific language to a very, very descriptive, non-hypothetical, non-experiential structure. So if you read a scientific paper today, it's very dry, right? It doesn't have any aspirational content.
Right.
As a matter of fact, they try to look. Well, about the same time, this happened in mathematics with a guy named Brewer, right? He said, you know, there's something very wrong here with what this guy Cantor has done. And he and a bunch of others created a movement to say we need to fix this. And Hilbert, a guy who was probably one of our better mathematicians in history, said the same thing. And if the movement failed in mathematics too, and that's because whatever you do, I'm not going to get into that. Anyway, it failed in mathematics. It also came about in economics by a guy named Mises. And Mises either didn't know or didn't understand what the other two groups were doing. But what he was trying to do with his work, and he didn't maybe understand it, was he was trying to create a science. So that's what you hear him do a lot. He says, I'm creating a science. Well, he doesn't really. He tries to create a logic, and a logic isn't the same thing as a science. It's not scientific, and that's because a logic is something that's internally consistent, has nothing to do with whether it's externally correspondent. But a science is externally correspondent, whether we can create an argument that's internally consistent to explain it one way or the other. So Mises actually ends up with his praxeology creating a pseudoscience. But, you know, he still gets some good stuff out of it, but he comes out of it. The problem is, while in math, you know, the way you sort of build something in math is very similar to the way you test it. You build it by a set of operations, test it by a set of operations.
Mm.
Well, you know, in science, well, you just want to be able to replicate it by following the same steps. I mean, you just want to make sure that that's it, and then you can go on and criticize it. But in economics, I'm going as shallow into this as I can until to make my point, shallowly into this as possible, is that in economics, that's where we needed operationalism to happen. Because it's where ethics exists. In other words, what happened in Keynes is he used mathematics to justify the forcible redistribution of money from some people to others, right?
Yep.
Whereas in what Mises was trying to say is, if you can't explain this as a series of rationally attainable human actions, in other words, something people would actually do out of their own interest, that's not pseudoscientific, that's not science, that's not economics, that's deception.
Right.
And so so what happened was, is the operational movement, the operational initiative failed, and it failed in philosophy, or in what we call logic, rhetoric, and philosophy as well. And strangely enough, it succeeded in psychology, which, if you look at a paper in 1975 and you look at a paper in psychology today, those are very different things, and it's because it became very clear by the 1960s and 70s that psychology was a pseudoscience, completely devoid of empirical content. And so the profession, in an attempt to rescue itself from pseudoscience, adopted the same thing physicists had, which was operational language, a scientific method of making observations. And so what happened is, what we get out of that transformation is the Pinker revolution.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. As we start to get we get Kahneman out of that. We get Pinker out of that. We get Jonathan Haidt out of that. We get the dramatic change since mid-1990s in philosophy, as well as the same change in behavioral economics. So we've rescued it. But if I look at it in general, the movement of the operational movement, which is saying, can this thing possibly exist? Can this be true? Because can it exist? That movement failed. And so what I've tried to do is show that we can bring morality and science together by bringing operationalism, full accounting, and tests of objective morality together into testimonialism, which says, unless you can prove that you've criticized any theory on all five or six of these axes, you can't tell me that it's true. You can't tell me that it's scientific. What you can really only tell me is, if you haven't tested it for objective morality, voluntary transfers, if you haven't tested it for that, you're just lying to me for your own advantage. You're doing a selection bias. If you can't do full accounting, again, you're lying to me, because you're saying it's okay to increase consumption even if we're burning down a 2,000 years of normative institutional development.
Exactly. Yeah.
You can't tell me that a mathematical, scientific, or economic process is true and existentially possible unless you can tell me how somebody can actually do that, how a rational actor would make those actions. So what I've tried to do is complete the Wilsonian synthesis by putting this together and restating science as truth-telling, at which point philosophy becomes really just a subset of science.
Very interesting. Now, so
if you can follow that, I love you. You know, I've made my day. If we get halfway through that, that's fine. In a short time.
There's a lot of things that you've... that you mentioned that obviously I want to pick up on and ask you more about, because it's fascinating what you said. But I'll see if I can structure some of my thoughts here around this. But when you say that it's failed, that of course is not predicated on the fact that we're still living within these systems today. Because when when you're talking about the Levantine or the Jewish system, if you will, that's failed. Isn't that, as someone said about the question, you know, what do you think of the French Revolution? Well, it's too early to tell, right? In other words,
yes,
still in that. It's still happening. But is it due to its failure that we now can see that we're in a downward spiral when it comes to our society and the Western world?
Well, I think what we're doing is we're paying a cost, a tremendous cost, for a century of pseudoscience. The question is, as other authors are bringing up, and I haven't talked with the other guys specifically about this, but we're paying the cost of a century and maybe a century and a half of pseudoscience. And we're doing that because we're a high-trust people. And so we have between 4,000 and 8,000 years of high trust, maybe 20,000 years of high trust, if you're going to go with the genetic explanation. So we have a really long, we've become really good at trusting each other. And so we don't have a healthy skepticism of especially when that healthy skepticism is confronted with the use of new media in the 19th and 20th century, which were first cheap, inexpensive print, followed by radio, followed by television, followed by a rapid decline in the rest of the world's economies, which allowed Americans in particular to lead a disproportionately, to shift a huge number of people out of labor and into what we call middle class, which is really just consumer consumption. And at the same time, we had also immigrated vast numbers of people who were no longer high trust Protestants. And lastly, what we did is we enfranchised women into the workforce, workforce doesn't matter, but into the politics without thinking that it was men who were voting rather than what we had previously held was a family has a vote, even if it's represented by the man, and male-female compromises are handled at home, and politics were just building commons. What happened when we added women in is, of course, they started following their reproductive strategy within one generation, and we would have never had anything left in the West if we hadn't allowed women in. But women have come in, and they've expressed their reproductive strategy, which is to bear children at will and throw the expense of their upkeep on the tribe.
Mm-hmm, right.
So it shouldn't be any surprise that if we take an ad, double the population, we drastically increase enfranchisement, remove all property costs from it. In other words, all evidence that you're a responsible producer before you have a say in the distribution of profits. If you remove all that and then you take away the multiple houses of government that allowed the classes to conduct exchanges. If you do all that, then, of course, you're going to get the expression of individual moral judgments. And you have to get the individual expression of moral judgments because there's nothing else you can vote on. You can't vote on particulars. And so you just vote on the moral position of the candidates. And so you get the very imprecise results. And that imprecise results is basically that, married families vote one way and unmarried women vote another way. And lower classes and races vote by their tribal influence, and you just have tribalism tribalism.
Yeah.
So it's really pretty obvious that the failure here is not only in our attempts to each of us promote universalism, right? It's that we lost we were too trustworthy, and we lost. We don't need to teach rhetoric and grammar anymore, which are like not teaching programming to programmers. we don't teach those things. We don't focus on how to testify, how to witness something testify, how to know whether we focus instead on how you feel. So what's happened is we had a very high trust society built on habituation of norms over very long periods of time and pervasive emphasis on truth telling and not free riding and the absolute nuclear family. And within 60 years, we basically destroyed the family, immigrated, people who don't have those experiences, don't have those family structures, don't have those moral codes, don't have those evolutionary strategies, have no experience of producing commons, and have no experience in preventing their own parasitism. So I sound really horrible right now, but it's just science.
Scientifically,
it's just science. It's just what it is.
So right.
If you start out with the initial problem, the West, if you say, well, we can all just get along and democracy is good, it's just a matter of time, and then you flip it around and say the entire Western competitive advantage that has dragged all of humanity out of ignorance and poverty, merely 500 years is based on the idea that we have a high enough suppression of free riding that we can pay the high cost of telling the truth to each other, and that we have to systematize scientific thinking across our whole population in order to do that. Well, that the whole future of mankind depends on the preservation of this fairly unique way of thinking. Then that's a very different That's a very different argument.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you've made, conclusions, if you will, about the system we live in that many people have never even begun to approach. So when you talk like this, they're like, what are you talking about? All we have to do is, adjust this economy, just have to take the money from over here and give it to these people here. And you know, in my view, they're like they're polishing the brass on the Titanic, as they say, because this is
what they're buying. They're doing is buying signals.
Right, right.
We forget that the humans have an amazing accounting system, right? We can't remember numbers for anything, right? If you pick a barrel of golf balls and try to estimate how many is in there, you won't even be close. But if you want to know whose status is higher than anybody else in a group of 1,000 people, you can send anybody in there, and they will know where they are in 10 seconds.
Right, right.
So we're amazing at this, and so this is what we do, right? Stat signaling is very important. We need to know who to imitate. We know it tells us who we can reproduce with. It tells us who we can associate with. Your value is your signal. Right? I mean, signaling is our value to one another. And so, you know, signaling is tremendously important. But on the other hand, there are ways to corrupt the signal economy. And the way to corrupt the signal economy is to give people stuff to give away that they didn't take, they didn't make.
Right, exactly.
And so what you really have is a demonstration of conspicuous consumption by Northern Europeans in particular, justification of it. Of conspicuous consumption as a means of attaining social status. But what they're really doing is spending down the entire civilization's accumulated capital within just a few generations.
So high-trust societies have been – well, I let me put that as a question instead. Do you think our high-trust society has been hacked or defeated, if you will, or is it simply a mistake on our part when we construct the system, we – made the assumption that we believe that everyone can be equal, right? We believe in egalitarianism or bringing everyone up to the same level. So which one do you favor there?
Well, you know, my view of the world, and I think it's just science, is that everything we say is negotiation on behalf of our reproductive strategy. In other words, it's justification. And so my view is that we're following incentives. We've created perverse incentives, and we're all following perverse incentives. So we're paying the price for our idealism. Now, you want to ask me, have we been hacked? The answer is yes, because the nonsense doesn't work very many places. It only works here, and it's worked really effectively. It worked just like it did with Christianity in Rome, and it's worked just this time around with pseudoscience in the West. So we had the first generation of mysticism, and this generation has come out as pseudoscience. And it's very, very, very easy to do. It's very hard to do, but if you have a chance at new media, in other words, you have the ability to write and move around the Roman territory, or if you have the ability to publish books and vast knowledge, get a hold of mass media and distribute pseudoscience and deceit, and you have cooperation on both sides. You both have neo-Puritans on one side, and you have the Germans stepping back and ignoring reality, or either that or going into German idealism as some sort of video game that's been practiced in intellectual circles for pure entertainment for purely entertainment purposes, or if you have the Jewish desire to make sure that they create this propaganda everywhere so that they can feel safe in a world that's tried to eliminate them. I mean, the whole world's tried to eliminate them. Everybody's doing what they do. The question is, you can criticize the neo-Puritans. You can criticize the socialist libertarians and neoconservatives. You can criticize the German idealists and social democrats. You can criticize those people. You can look in the mirror and say, what did I do wrong?
Right, exactly.
So I look at what do we do wrong.
Yeah.
What we did is not very complicated, and we did it completely by accident. And you can think of this as various guises, but I mean, we got rid of the fact that, you know, lying is a crime. If you called a woman in the 11th century a whore, the punishment for that was the same as if you hit a guy in the head with an axe and bared his skull,
right.
His brain. Mm. Right? You don't You don't do those things, right? So what happens when you tell a lie in a martial culture? Not just one like the Chinese martial culture or the Middle Eastern martial culture, which are slave armies. But when you have a militia, you know, I know my answer who my ancestors were in the 1300s.
Mm-hmm.
And they were captains and sergeants. And, you know, they went out and did their soldierly duty and then came back and worked the farm and the craft shop.
Right. Yeah.
And so what happens to martial people when they lie? They die.
Yeah.
So that's why we call it martial epistemology. You know, you want to ask Maxim Taleb, who is probably one of the better guys in the world on this, and he'll tell you, well, if you want to know who's going to tell you the most likely have the best epistemology, it's going to be the military guys because they're paranoid.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas, you know, if you're just sitting out here, some Western public intellectual writing on a website about how to give, you know, how can I get more status signals by giving away, by encouraging people to take something from somebody else, well, that's pretty cheap. The epistemology, there's no causal consequence for that action. So one of the things we did is we took away, in the common law, we took away universal standing, and we did that so that the state could give the protection to chartered organizations. And if you and I could instead, every time someone lied, you know, every corporation did something bad, go to court and take them to court, you'd have a lot less trouble policing them than we do trying to get our government to police them.
Right, right.
So it was the loss of universal standing that was the first thing. And the second thing was the error in the freedom of speech, which I'm sure our ancestors assumed was freedom of truthful speech. We got rid of the duel first, which turns out was a really good thing to have. We got rid of the duel. We got rid of libel, slander. We even had a hard time suppressing deceit in advertising.
Right.
But right now, I mean, the problem is even if we suppress that, we have no way of suppressing pseudoscience. And so, but if we went back in time and Mises hadn't failed and Brewer hadn't failed and Brigman hadn't failed and Minsky has come out of computer science now as sort of, I think he might almost get it. If those guys hadn't failed, we could have suppressed pseudoscience in the 1930s or 40s and saved ourselves from it. But what happened is we didn't. And so now what's happening is science, part of the conservative movement, is using science to wash away a century of pseudoscience, and it's very expensive and time-consuming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's what you're seeing happen now. I mean, I always take Pinker as the line of demarcation between the end of the pseudoscientific generation and the reemergent scientific generation. So that's where I am.
Very interesting. Obviously, we have much more to talk about here and get into, Kurt. But we can take a break here, actually, in a little bit, and then continue and pick up in the second hour. Many more questions for you, obviously. But let's just talk about your website a little bit. If there's anything you'd like to let us know about, obviously, people can read about the basics and the fundamentals. You have a lot of articles and things on your website. Do you have any... do you have any plans to publish any works on this in the future?
Yeah, well, I think my editors say I'm really about done with everything. It's a matter of getting it down into digestible form. And honestly, if you listen to TRS or your show on Red Ice Radio, it's a lot easier to understand this in person during a dialogue than it is to write something that's, this is sort of like trying to learn Marxism, right? I mean, it's non-trivial. It's a big set of ideas. Or
right.
I mean, nobody's tried to do this except, you know, Heidegger tried a little bit, Marx tried, you know, Kant tried. It's actually an insane project that no self-respecting public intellectual, academic, who actually knew what he was doing would do something of this size. I just stumbled into it, and that's how it happened. So propertarianism.com is my website, and what I do is that I have a place called Propertarianism in there, and as I get a chapter ready, I'm going to put it up there, and then I'm going to let people comment on it. What I do right now is I basically work through a series of problems. I sketch them out in my head, then I sort of test them on Facebook because I have some believe it or not, I get great criticism there from some very smart people. And it helps me talk to people who aren't super geeks. So I learn to try to get it down into some digestible language. And then what I do is I select the better pieces that are cogent, and I put them up on my website. And then when I'm going to write a chapter, I pull all the stuff that's related out of those books and use it as my index cards, and I write that in Scrivener. And when I get ready to push a chapter up there, I will. So eventually I'll have a book there. I'll have a book out of that, but I always go back to, Spinoza spent his entire life writing 200 pages, and I might be in the same, I might have the same problem.
Right, exactly. Now, of course, as you said, website is proprietarianism.com. We'll have that link up. Do you have do you want to share your Facebook page or something like that for people to get in touch with you?
Kurt Doolittle. I'm just Facebook, Kurt Doolittle. You can search for that, and I'm pretty well known. So. And I'm really open, right? I really don't go for sentimental, hey, yeah, dude stuff. That doesn't do me any good. But if you want to ask questions, I take people pretty seriously, and I try to be helpful.
Excellent. I'm sure many in our audience will appreciate that. All right. Well, stay with us, Kurt. We'll take a short break here, and then we'll pick up in the second segment right after the break.
You think you're going to live your life alone, in darkness, in seclusion. Yeah, I know. You've been out there, tried to mix with those animals, and it just left you full of humiliated confusion. So you stagger back home and wait for nothing. But the solitary refinement of your room spits you back out onto the street, and now you're desperate and in need of human contact. And then you meet me. Whole world changes because everything I say is everything you've ever wanted to hear. So you drop all your defenses and you drop all your fears and you trust me completely. I'm perfect in every way. So I make you feel so strong and so powerful inside. You feel so lucky. But your ego obscures reality, and you never bother to wonder why things are going so well. You want to know why? 'Cause I'm a liar! Things that you already know, so you can say, I really identify with you so much. And all the time that you're needing me is just the time that I'm bleeding you. Don't you get it yet? I'll come to you like an affliction. But I'll leave you like an addiction. You'll never forget me. You wanna know why? 'Cause I'm a liar. because now I see the destructive power of a lie. They're stronger than truth. I can't believe I ever hurt you. I swear, I will never lie to you again. Please, just give me one more chance. I will never lie to you again. I swear. I will never tell a lie. I will never tell a lie. No. No.
Second hour is coming up at redicemembers.com. Don't miss our continuation if you want to hear more about proprietarianism and the ideas from Kurt Doolittle. It ties perfectly into many of the other things that we've discussed on the program. We have more coming this week as well. Jack Sen, who was booted out from UKIP. We have the guys from the Daily Showa, the Right Stuff Goys, and many more after this. We are also, of course, continuing our work on the Charleston church shooting in between all of this to be able to bring you the most in-depth analysis of this strange and contradiction-ridden event that I believe you will ever see, including putting it in context in regards to how the event is being used. So please stay tuned for much more. RedIceMembers.com is the website. We'll talk to you after the break.